It's a pleasure to have Rabbi Kelson, Rabbi Dr. Kelson with him. I think he got his PhD quite recently from NYU on the Pieshna Rebbe, I believe. Yes. This is why it's really an area of his specialty. He was a Wexner Fellow. He serves now as the Dean of YCT Rabbinic School, and haven't seen him for a few years. We had the pleasure of hosting him in Toronto probably 5-6 years ago already. And I think that's the last time we've seen each other. So it's a pleasure to have you, and the first of two sessions, and we'll let you give take it from here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. No, it's nice to see you, and the pleasure is mine. Thank you everyone for tuning in on a Sunday night. So I'm actually away from all of my Svarim and books because of the quarantine. So I will do what I can in terms of sharing documents and use via the share screen feature. So I wanted to speak this evening about spiritual legacy, spiritual path of the Pieshna Rebbe. I can't really see people's faces and not sure how many people are familiar, but over the past 3 decades or so, I would estimate, in the North American Jewish community, the writings of the Pieshna Rebbe of Kolonimus Kalman Shapira. If you hold one moment, I will share an image of the Rebbe. There you go. Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro have attracted increasing attention over the, of course, the past 30 or so years. Now, this is mostly due, no doubt, and this may be why some of you have heard of him before, if you should have heard of him, due to the sensational circumstances under which the Rebbe's writings, or many of his writings, were found, which were in the, they survived the Warsaw Ghetto, buried underneath in what was called the Ringelblum Onik Shabbos Archives. This was a archives produced by contemporaneous Jewish laypeople and historians who were endeavoring to record and document the ongoings of the Warsaw Ghetto. And many of his writings were found there, including some of the ones I want to speak about tonight. And he's also was known, Nechemia Poland from Boston, if you're familiar with him, wrote an English study of some of his Holocaust drashot under the title of Esh Kodesh, holy fire. So anachronistically, we could call him a Holocaust theologian. These were Esh Kodesh is essentially many drashot which were offered to his flock on Shabbatot and holidays during those dark years of 1939 to 1943 in the Warsaw Ghetto, posthumously published under the title again of Esh Kodesh, translated into English twice and have been analyzed by several scholars. But the drashot are actually quite remarkable for both their theological weightiness. They're dealing with questions of theodicy, of God's presence, of God's emotions in relation to Israel, and for the homiletic interpretations of contemporaneous events. So that's basically why about 30 or so years ago, 30, 40 years ago, the Pieshna's writing started to attract scholarly attention in the English-speaking world, at least. More recently, there's a second wave of interest because of his pre-World War II writings. These writings were dedicated, they're basically chassidut, but dedicated for to sustain and pragmatic focus on spiritual practice, including instruction in meditative techniques and the general cultivation of religious consciousness within the context of a community of practitioners, rather than solo or hitbodedut. This was a community of practitioners dedicated to very rigorous and systematic, disciplined spiritual practice. So those, because of those practices and those writings, including the meditative writings and practices, there's a second wave of interest in the Rebbe. Over the past, I'd say more recently, 10, 20 years, especially in, but not limited to, Jewish renewal and neo-Hasidic circles. My interest in the Rebbe focused primarily on a series of his educational works. Because the truth is that of all the Hasidic authorities of the time, in my sense is that the Pieshna Rebbe wrote the most prolifically and systematically on education. He actually was known as Ha'admor, or he was called by some Ha'admor HaMichanich, the educating or the pedagogic Rebbe. He wasn't only a theoretician, he had a relatively large yeshiva in Warsaw for boys age around 10 till, you know, young adult men age around 25, about 300 students in his yeshiva Das Moshe. I think it might have been the second largest Hasidic yeshiva in Warsaw at the time. And not only, however, did he have this big yeshiva, but he wrote a series of educational works, which were, only one of which was published during his lifetime. That's probably the most famous one, Chovat HaTamidim. Chovas HaTamidim, a student's obligation, again, translated into English. The others, Hachsharat HaAvrichim, preparation of Avrechim, young Hasidic students. These are all males. And Mevo HaSharim, entrance to the gates. These were actually not published during his lifetime. They were, however, found again in the Ringelblum archive. What I did in my dissertation, which is not exactly the focus of tonight and next week, but to contextualize my interest in him, I studied his educational philosophy, and I situated it both within Hasidic thought and within Western educational philosophy, especially comparing him to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And I also produced an original translation and annotation of his Mevo HaSharim. I'll note that his Mevo HaSharim was the third of this educational trilogy, which is very rare, right, to have this it is explicitly educational work produced by a Hasidic Rebbe. And not only one work, but three works. In fact, it was meant to be four, because Mevo HaSharim was meant to be the table of contents, as it were, that's to say the introduction to his ultimate work, Chovat Avrechim, not a student's obligation, but the Avrech, the advanced Chassid's obligation, where he's meant to speak to those advanced Chassidim in their spiritual practice. He was murdered before he was able to actually compose that work, so we only have those three. So what I want to do tonight, and as Jay mentioned, or Kelvin mentioned before, I will try to watch the chat box, but it's difficult to do all these things at once. So, you know, I'll take a look. So far, I don't see any messages, but I'll try to check that occasionally. And feel free, someone to just, you know, ping me somehow if I'm ignoring any questions. But I'll try to leave time for that. I want to do this tonight. This is a two-part series. Tonight, I want to introduce you to the PSS Ner Rebbe, a little bit about just a short biographical sketch, a little bit about who we're talking about. Then a little bit of a deeper introduction to his literary works. But for the most of this evening, I wanted to introduce you to his spiritual path, because, you know, part of what's so interesting to myself, and I think to many others, and perhaps I hope to you as well, in his literary estate and his lived legacy, was that he left a detailed, first of all, he had a passion for spiritual practice and spiritual development within Hasidism and beyond, right? So he's living, you know, by the time he's around, which we'll talk about in a moment, but we're talking about, you know, early to mid 20th century, you know, Hasidism has been around for more than 100 years. And like any movement, you know, it has become institutionalized to an extent. It's become not only a signifier of a spiritual practice or a way of spiritual path, but it's a sociological category. Hasidim are not only people who are pious, but they're people who belong to the Hasidic community. And part of what he was trying to do was to re-energize and to reform, if you will, Hasidism from within, to rejuvenate it, to return it to its origins, right? Some have called him actually like an Orthodox neo-Hasid. I know that in some parts of the North America, we talk about neo-Hasidism, referring to non-normative or anormative, certainly non-Orthodox movements. He was an Orthodox traditionalist revivalist, if you will, right? Trying to rejuvenate Hasidism to bring it back to its core message and motivation. That was a really incredibly large task. Let me open the chat for a second. I see a chat. The PSS is Rav's half-brother. Shimon Haberman was a member of the Onik Shabbos group. He probably is one of his brothers. Yes, there are people who do indeed say that. There's some kind of, there's some like There's different accounts of how exactly his writings made their way into the Onuk Shabbos group, but that definitely is a theory that I've heard. There's also different accounts about how they were found. There's a scholar named Daniel Reiser who is a really excellent scholar in Israel, who recently produced a critical edition of Ish Kodesh, and he documents the various stories of the finding of the manuscripts of being buried. But thank you for that note from Miriam. Let's again return. Here's again the image, an image of the Rebbe, and we'll jump in, as I was saying, to take a look at his some of his spiritual legacy and the spiritual path that he lays out. Without further ado, I mean we're living in Poland, right, in the course of the story, in the late 19th century and earlier 20th century, Kolonimus Kalman, or Kolonimus Kalmish, as he sometimes signs his name in the diminutive, is born into Polish Hasidic aristocracy. He's born in Grudzinsk in Poland in 1889. His father, Rabbi Melech, was a rather important Hasidic Rebbe in Grudzinsk, and he's descended from some of the greats of Polish Hasidism, including Rabbi Melech Luzhensk. And Rabbi Melech was grandfather of Kolonimus Kalman of Krakow, the Maor Vashemesh, for whom Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro, our Rebbe, is named. But the point is that he comes out of Polish Hasidic aristocracy, from the spiritual line of the Seer of Lublin, right, the Chose of Lublin. This is not a topic right now, but there is a split within Polish Hasidism at some point where you have the line of the Chose of Lublin, the Seer of Lublin, Rebbe Melech Luzhensk. That's where Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro comes out of. There's others like Pshisk, Kutsk, Ger, right? So that's a different branch of Polish Hasidism, and they have their machlokot, they have their debates. The predecessor is not from that group, and they had their debates, including about the propriety of teaching esoteric Kabbalistic teachings, in quasi-public. In any event, Rebbe Melech, Kolonimus Kalman's father, dies when he's quite young, when Kolonimus is only 3 years old. So he ends up being raised in the household, and because of the way the marriage has worked and the age of marriage, he gets raised in the household of his nephew, who is quite much older than him. His nephew is a child of Rebbe Melech's daughter from a previous marriage. So he's raised in his nephew, but really kind of his uncle's home, Rachmiel Moshe, who's the cousin Sir Rebbe, and a descendant of the Maggid of Kuznets. So Kuznets becomes very important to the predecessor's lineage. I'll just note at this point that we're speaking about some of these Polish Hasidic names, Rebbe Melech Luzhensk, the Chose of Lublin, the Maggid of Kuznets, if you're familiar with these names. And here I have a map up, if you can see it, some of those areas, some of that area around. Here's Warsaw, right? You see my cursor over here. And you have here Pshisk, you have Krakow down here, and here's PSSN right here, about 10 kilometers out of Warsaw. Here's Ger, right, what we call Ger. Here's Kutsk, right, his Kuznets. Okay, so it's all in this is the area that we're talking about. And PSSNO is this, PSSCHNA is a rather small village. I think there were maybe about 5,000 residents at the time of the PSSNA Rebbe. I think half were Jewish, but relatively small. We'll see how he gains some fame. And then he's raised right by his nephew, uncle, right, the Rebbe of Kuznets over here, and his brother from his father's second marriage, whose name is Yeshaya Shapiro, he moves to Palestine, and he becomes known as Admor HaChalutz, the pioneer Admor, for his Zionistic activities and leanings. So that's a different lecture entirely, but it just shows you that this family is kind of interesting, right? You're this Hasidic descendant of Kuznets who becomes Admor HaChalutz. Now he's 13, he's engaged to marry Rachel Chaya Miriam, his great niece. they have a son and a daughter. And long story short, after his nephew slash uncle, right, Rav Shmuel Moshe dies in 1909, so some of the Hasidim becomes followers of that Rebbe's son, but others basically follow Columbus Kalman Shapiro, who's 20. He's only 20 years old at the time, and he becomes Rebbe in Piasetzno. The truth is, there's other Hasidic Rebbe's in Piasetzno. He becomes known as the Piasetzno Rebbe only later on when he moves to Warsaw. Because you're not usually called, you know, when you move elsewhere, then you're called by the name of the place that you came from, right? So there's a few different Hasidic Rebbe's there. He moves to Warsaw. Eventually, he also becomes, he adopts the office of city rabbi of Piasetzno, and altogether becomes known as the Piasetzno Rebbe. In Warsaw, he's very active in the newly formed Agudat Israel, right? Agudas Israel. He is an active, devoted leader for his Hasidim. As I mentioned, he has not only Hasidim, but a yeshiva of 300 or so students in his yeshiva called Dad Moshe, which again is named after his father-in-law, Yerachmiel Moshe. So it's called Das Moshe. And this is his Hasidic yeshiva. His wife passes away. There are actually notes in his books where he says, you know, at this point, my wife, who edited my works, right, told me, you know, if it was taken from me, but she said I should mention something here, mention something there. So we see that she was helping to edit his works. And they were close. The short of it, though, is that, you know, during World War II, you know, he's in Warsaw. He lives in the Warsaw ghetto. He continues to try to lead his flock, to run Hasidic tishes and Shabbases, and to teach. That's what the sermons I mentioned before, Ish Kodesh, are from. He loses, you know, in the horrors of the ghetto, he loses his son, his daughter-in-law, his sister-in-law. His daughter, I believe, is deported. They weren't sure exactly what happened. Somehow, it seems, in the midst of that hell, he continued to compose and edit Hasidic works. Not only his drashot, which he's offering at the time, right, in situ of the ghetto, but he continues to edit his works, which we're going to focus on in just a few minutes, including two works, Hachsharas HaAvrechem, right, the Avrech's preparation, the young Chassid's preparation, how to become a true Chassid, a true pious person within his definition, and Mevoh HaShaarim, entrance to the gates, which is even a greater step, right? It's even a more advanced step for older Chassidim. It appears he had the opportunity to escape the ghetto in Poland at large, but he refuses to leave his flock, and he's murdered in 1943. We only have these writings, again, because they were, you know, buried and then discovered in the Ringelblum archives. The manuscripts are currently held in Warsaw in the Jewish Historical Museum there. They sent me, when I was working on my dissertation, PDFs of the manuscripts. And you see here, I don't know if you can see it, but you see here, Harini Hashem Narkecha. Right here is the opening Sefer Chovat Avrichim. Right, this is the opening page of the manuscript of Mevoh HaShaarim, which I worked on. Here is an image of the manuscript itself. I don't know if you can see. Let me see if I can zoom in a little bit. One moment, please. And you'll see, the truth is, it's actually not even his handwriting. It was produced, it's a little bit better. It's produced by this paragraph, produced by a copyist. You can see how nicely it's written. And the Rebbe did was he then glossed it and edited. In some pages, you see, you know, his handwriting, crossing things out, making notes, etc., which were incorporated into the printings. So these works were only printed, post after the war in a couple of different printings, etc. Let me pause here. Any comments or questions? I'll try to remember to do that and take a look at the chat box. Or people, it's fine with me if people want to unmute. I don't know what the policy here is exactly.
You can go ahead. I would suggest. Yeah.
Okay, I will go ahead, and you know, you'll let me know.
We'll let people unmute at the end.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. The teaching in person, so different energy. Okay, so, you know, very briefly, I want to mention a few of his works I haven't mentioned yet. I mentioned the Educational Trilogy, beginning with the Student's Obligation, Chovas HaTalmidim, and moving on to, let me just close the chat, excuse me, moving on to Hachsharas HaAvreichim, and then to Mavo HaSharim, right? This is a systematic, I would call it a developmentalist educational treatise. It's a trilogy, really, but it's one large extended project. What he's attempting to do, which is, I think, rather unique, is to systematize Hasidic training. Again, how he understands Hasidic training. Systematize Hasidic training, starting from a relatively young age. We don't know exactly what age, but you see here that this is a receipt, a fundraising receipt, actually, from the yeshiva Das Moshe, from his yeshiva, right? Tachas Hashkachat Admor Shlita Mipiasetzna, under the Piasetzna Rebbe's, you know, supervision. And you see here that they're enlisting, they're itemizing, you know, elements of the yeshiva, including Mispar HaTalmidim, Karov Le Shalosh Me'od, about 300 students. I think that says Hagil Min, right, 10 to 25, right? Min Eser Ad Esumechamesh Shanim. So you see the students were started from the Rosh and 10 before Bar Mitzvah already. So if we can assume that Chovas HaTalmidim, that their first book in the series was aimed for someone around that age, this age, it starts from the age around 10, excuse me. So imagine a 10-year-old reader. So he's speaking to a 10-year-old boy. And actually, one of the things that he does in this educational series is speak to the 10-year-old boy and then speak to him again as he grows older and develops further his spiritual capacities, his spiritual practice, his avoda in Hasidic parlance, and then speaks to him again in Mavo HaSharim as he's older now, even yet older, perhaps married, really dedicating himself to spiritual excellence. So that sort of exquisite focus on the development of the Hasid and speak, you know, and framing Hasidic practice and avoda in developmental stages is, I think, rather unique and might account for part of the popularity of Chovas HaTalmidim. Right, so in other words, many Hasidic works might have some spiritual advice, but it's sort of thrown out, you know, as if it's all of one cloth, right? One Hasidic reader, as it were, without any attention paid to, well, where is this person in their development, in their spiritual practice? Right, the Piasetzner attempts to systematize that, again, in his own understanding. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. Sometimes you see that in Hasidic literature, there's a preoccupation with the notion of machshavos zaros, machshavot zarot, which is during prayer, maybe other times, but especially during prayer, when one is attempting to achieve kavanah and focus, and one will, let's see what the chat is, achieve kavanah and focus. The quality of your voice is very unclear. Okay, I will try to speak more clearly. Okay, I'll try to speak more clearly. So when the one second, sounds very clear to me. Okay,
yeah. So we'll see. It's pretty clear. I've not a problem, but you know,
I will do my best. I will do my best. I'm sorry, I don't have a better microphone with me right
Sometimes
now.
It's individual than their own thing. Go on. You're doing fine.
I will carry on. Okay, thank you. So sometimes, you know, in Hasidic literature, you practice with machshava zara. So you're trying to achieve kavanah or focus, and you get these other random thoughts in your head, right? Foreign thoughts. Maybe they're of a particular, you know, sort of illicit quality, or maybe they're just distracting. So what do you do with those thoughts? So you'll see two different types of stratagems spoken about, right, in the literature. One is, we could basically call it some form of repression, which is, you know, try to find a way to push that thought aside and to refocus yourself on the task at hand, on the prayer at hand, if you will, for one example. That's one strategy, you know, sort of repression or just refocusing. There's also reference to the notion of a sort of a turning, right? I think he calls it itapachia, flipping over, turning. And you see this already in early Hasidic literature, where there's a sense that you can actually take that machshava zara, that foreign, illicit, distracting thought, and they talk about turning it to its root. What that means is, I'll give an example as appears in the text. Imagine, you know, a male prayer, someone prayer, davener, is davening, is praying, and they have thought, lustful thoughts of for a woman. Imagine a woman, a real woman, a machshava zara. So the repression approach would say, okay, so try to like get rid of that thought and refocus yourself on the prayer at hand. So do what you can to refocus yourself, right? Maybe you pause and you try to focus on God's name or look at the sky and focus on heavenly things, or maybe you shuckle more when you do different techniques, right? You daven out loud and you clap, different techniques to like refocus yourself. All right, that's one approach. But this approach, it says, and that embedded within, or say like inherently implicated with that lust for another person, is in fact desire, perhaps even we would say love and lust for the divine, for God. And therefore, what one needs to do is, rather than banish that thought, one needs to turn that thought back to its roots. That is to say, to locate within that lust for another person the spark or the root of lust or love for the divine, and to channel, to take that thought, that feeling sometimes, and find within it the connection with the divine. Okay, so that you could elaborate much further on those points, but I just wanted to say that those are two different ways of dealing with machshavot zarot. And you can imagine a Hasidic boy in Warsaw, for example, a Hasidic man in Warsaw, just to give this example, of 19, whatever, 30, saying, I don't know, which one should I do? Now you get different advice in different places. What the P.S. Setzner says, here he might be influenced by Chabad, what P.S. Setzner says is, well, it depends what level of worship you're at, what level of avoda, what level of spiritual practice you're at, because the turning strategy is harder than the repression strategy. So at an early stage, what you do is essentially repress and refocus. But as you develop into a more adept chassid, you can be taught to turn such thoughts to their roots. That's just one example of the Rebbe, the Ascension Rebbe, trying to walk the chassid, hold the chassid's hand step by step, by developmental and educational step, among the rungs, the madrigot of avoda, of Hasidic worship, of Hasidic spiritual practice. And that itself is an enormous contribution. Now, there was a work, there are two works that were published before the war. One was, I mentioned, Chovas HaTalmidim, Chovat HaTalmidim, the student's obligation. There was another called, I don't know if anyone's familiar, B'nei Machshava Tova. It wasn't really published in the sense of, you know, open to printing press for the and sold in bookstores. B'nei Machshava Tova, actually, in a few minutes, turn to a passage from B'nei Machshava Tova to give you a sense and, you know, walk you into the palace of the Rebbe's teachings here. B'nei Machshava Tova sometimes is translated as, you know, I think so there's an English translation called Conscious Community, right? Machshava, consciousness. There's been other translations as well. But the short of it is, B'nei Machshava Tova was actually a secret pamphlet. It was not allowed to be distributed widely. And it was meant for a small cadre, a small cohort. The term they use is Chavraya Kadisha. Chavraya, Chavra. This is the term used in Zoharic literature for the group around Rashbi, around the protagonist of the Zohar. It's coming up to Lag BaOmer here. So a small cohort or cadre, a chavraya, of kind of Hasidic young elites, right? Like special forces. The idea being that he's not the only one who had a similar notion at the time, interestingly, that if you are trying to rejuvenate, to revitalize, to inject a new energy, a refocusing, a strengthening of Hasidism, of Hasidut at the time, One strategy would be, and this is what he wrote this in the 20s, would be to gather around oneself a small group of dedicated young Hasidim who were, as I said, dedicated to each other as a cohort, and dedicated to very rigorous, very intensive Hasidic practice and avodah. So he gathered around himself this B'nai Machshava Tova, the people of Machshava Tova. I'll translate that in a few minutes, but we can call for now good Machshava, good developed consciousness, I guess we'll call it for now. And the idea was that from that sort of center would emerge, perhaps in concentric circles, a rejuvenation, a renaissance of Hasidism at the time. Right? You remember that early in the Hasidic myth is the notion that the Messiah will only come when the Baal Shem Tov's teachings emerge forward, right? Overflow. Right? So it's actually a world redemptive activity within this conception to rejuvenate Hasidism. I actually think that you could argue, one of my sort of friends, senior colleagues, has argued, you know, sort of sparked this idea in me, that the educational series of Chuvas HaTamidim, etc., from later on, were kind of a reworking of B'nai Machshava Tova. So this earlier work of B'nai Machshava Tova, geared towards these spiritual elites, doesn't really have this developmentalist focus. So maybe what he did was, it seems like, or I would argue what he did was, he first had this idea of B'nai Machshava Tova, let me, you know, have these spiritual shock troops, right? This elite core of Hasidic practitioners. And then a few years later, he thought to himself, you know what, if you're really going to be successful, you need to start young and train people from their youth in this world called Hasidism, and then walk them step by step as they get older. You can't just sort of talk to them only when they're 20, 25 at that point. You know, it might be too late, right? Notice to really have an impact, you have to start quite young and have a culture, educational culture geared towards producing real Hasidim. So he has been in Machshava Tova. We also have some of his teachings from before the war, Derech HaMelech, the way of the king, the path of the king. And I mentioned his drashot, Esh Kodesh, etc. There's one more piece, Tzav Ziruz. He actually wrote a spiritual diary of sorts where he has different ruminations and different thoughts, some apparently autobiographical, others you know, less explicitly so, but thoughts about spiritual practice. So in a sense, it's kind of like a window into the inner life of a Hasidic Rebbe living at that time, which is itself quite amazing. So basically, in short, you have this like very, you know, sort of interesting and, you know, sizable, I'd say, literary legacy of this Rebbe, and he's an enormous import, right? He's actually was a prominent Polish Hasidic Rebbe during the time, and his teachings, which have been just rediscovered more in the past, you know, decades, have really sparked a tremendous amount of interest both in Israel and in North America, actually Europe as well, but in Israel and North America, certainly in this figure in PSS and Rebbe. Okay, let me take one moment to look at the chat again. Where can we get his personal diary? Is it published? It is published. Tzav Viziruz. It's actually translated into English. So I'll tell you that Hachshara Tzav Recha, my books are not with me right now because I've got some quarantine away. I'm sequestered from them. But Hachshara Tzav Recha, Mevor Sharim, and Tzav Viziruz are all published together. And in addition, I think maybe first by the Vad Chassidi Piasetzno in Tel Aviv and then by Feldheim. I'm speaking to Miriam's question right now. I think Tzav Viziruz was, I'm pretty sure it was translated into English. I'm forgetting the name of the translation, but someone translated it into English and you can can easily, you know, get a hold of that as well. Okay, but they're published within one book, certainly by Feldheim. Okay, so you know, I hope that, you know, what I've done so far is give you some broad context of his biography and of his literary legacy and of his general import. Maybe one more thing I should say is that, you know, he's living during during, like I say, 1889 to 1943. But his prominent activities in the 20s and in the 30s, the interbellum period within Europe, this is a time marked by great upheaval for Europe in general, of course, and that includes his Jewish residents. Great upheaval and also great creativity, partly sparked by that upheaval. What I mean in part is that, you know, so many Jews are killed, you know, during the war, after the war. And in the course of that upheaval, many Jews, including many Hasidic rabbis, move from the outlying provinces into Warsaw proper. I'll just go back to that map for a second. If I can get back there quickly. Yes. So, right, so many Jews, right, move from these outlying provinces, right, into Warsaw, including the PSS and Rebbe, but many, many others. I think there are 26 Hasidic Rebbes living in Warsaw at the time. And as a result of that urbanization, you have both great attrition, well, not only as a result of that urbanization, but partly, at least related to that urbanization, there's tremendous attrition within Hasidic ranks, right? So many young Hasidim, that is to say, people who are born into Hasidic families are leaving, you know, observance at large, certainly Hasidism, for no ideology or for competing ideologies, socialism or communism, Bundism or Zionism, or secularism, etc. So it's a tremendous attrition, even within the Hasidic family, even with the Hasidic noble families, right? So I saw somewhere that what would happen not infrequently is that the eldest son, let's say, of a Hasidic Rebbe's family, of a Rebbe's family, would become the next Rebbe, and the other sons would just leave Hasidism entirely, right? Because there's nowhere for them to go. So the point is that you're in this place of great upheaval and obviously a tremendous attrition, death, but attrition, urbanization. At the same time, you have this creativity because you have all these people living together within Warsaw, right? So they're all interacting. The Rebbe seems to know a lot more things than you would have thought that's a Rebbe from, you know, someone from this little, you know, village of Piasetsno might know. I can't get into that right now. And he's in the same streets as Hillel Zeitlin. I mean, we don't know if he knew Hillel Zeitlin, but there's some interesting commonalities in his teachings and Hillel Zeitlin's teachings. Abraham Joshua Heschel, I assume, is around there at the same time, and others as well. So it's a really interesting period in which we find ourselves. Okay, so what is this all about? What's the Piasetsno Rebbe's, you know, Polish Hasidic legacy about, and why has it attracted so much attention of late? So it's 9:09, so I want to spend a few minutes now, basically most of the rest of our time before we pause for some questions, taking a look at some of his teachings. And what I have here is a selection from, or the part selling from the beginning of his B'nai Machshava Tova. Again, I don't have the hard copy with me. That's in my office, I believe. But, you know, this is off of Hebrew wiki source, thankfully for that. And let's take a look. What I want to do is take a look at that text together. Rick Kelman, can people see that on the screen? See this? Okay, great. Okay, beautiful. So we'll take a look at this text together. And I simply want to, you know, I'll read it in translate and try to interpret and explain a little bit for about 10 or 15 minutes and bring you into the text proper of one of his early published or quasi, you know, published, very limitedly published pamphlets designed to teach spiritual practice. Okay, so here we go. This is after, by the way, he spoke in the beginning about the rules of the chevra, right, the rules of the cohort, which are really sort of tight and interesting. And I recommend that, or you take a look at it either now or not in the second, but, you know, at some other time. So here's what he says. Right, Yisod HaChevra, Ot Aleph. It says, HaPasuk Miyaseret Yisrael VaOmer. The verse rebukes Israel in the verse in Deuteronomy, right, that rebukes Israel. You have Sor Yilatcheteshi, right? The rock which has birthed you, you have, I believe it means you have sort of forgotten, right, or been weakened with, Vatashkach el mecholeka, and you have forgotten. This is the part he really wants to focus on. You've forgotten the God who has formed you. You've forgotten the God who has formed you. So he says, let me go back to that page. He says, the verse rebukes Israel. It says, you've forgotten God. Zehu ikar hasiba shemerecheket adam min halokav. This is the primary reason, primary cause that people become distanced from their God. That you see that the intimate terminology from his personal God. What makes a person on the individual level distanced from God? What removes them from God? And you could say many things. He says, interestingly, it's forgetfulness. Some form of forgetfulness is the primary, if you will, the primary sin, the primary cause of the cleavage between the individual and his God. Right? As he cites from Rabbi Melech Lizhensk, right, his ancestor, he prays right before prayer. Rabbi Lizhensk would say, let our machshava, tehei machshavotenu, remember the book is called B'nei Machshava Tova, let our machshava be zaka, slula, bura v'chazaka. Interesting words. Let it be pure and unsullied and clear and strong. He seems to here be, when he says B'nei Machshava Tova, good Machshava, he seems to be referring to these types of broader characteristics. So those, I should say, more narrow characteristics, and Tova is kind of like a catch-all for clear and strong Machshava. I should note right away, he says later on, when he says Machshava, he does not mean in this context, this is super important to understanding his path, he does not mean what we might call discursive cogitations, right? Discursive thinkings about ideas and arguments, like thinking in that sense. He does not mean that. Okay, what he means by machshava, and he articulates this later on, is something much closer to consciousness, a state of internal mental, but also somewhat emotional activity. And he also, in certain respects, in certain contexts, he means something more specific, apparently, which is machshava as imagination, even visualizations, right? Those types of thoughts, if you will. So not discursive thinking about a Gemara, right? Thinking about any other type of rational argument discursively, right? Marked by verbiage. No. He's talking about something very different. It's a different experience. He's talking about machshava, zaka, bura, chazaka, a strong consciousness, right? Which sometimes expresses itself in awareness and sometimes expresses itself in meditations, imaginations, visualizations. You can see already why, as mindfulness and meditation has taken the West by storm, including in the Jewish world, there would have been great excitement to rediscover this, Hasidic mindfulness, if you will, master. He wouldn't use the term mindfulness per se, although I wonder what you think of that term. So he says as follows. The prayer of Melech Lizhensk is that our machshavot should be strong, essentially. That is the opposite of the forgetfulness he mentions earlier. So if the primary sin is forgetfulness, the primary avoda is a strong, or a primary remedy for that sin, at least, or that failing would be a strong machshava. What does he mean? He goes on to explain. Kol yish yodea, everyone knows, shebeim haya ro'eh be'einav mamash, that if he would literally see, and I think here he literally, right? If you will to use your eyes and see the physical world, and in that physical world perceive echu omei lifnei Hashem. Understand that at that very moment he stands in front of God. I'm harping on the word mamash here because this notion of Hasidic thought, Hasidic sight, Rebbe Einav, as someone who can perceive the divine, right? Mamash, in the very physical reality, is very crucial to the PSS scenario's path. And I mentioned, I called this, this series, Hasidic Prophets. Maybe I'll explain right away now, since it's 9:16 already, what I mean by that. The Rebbe lays out a path here in his later works and other places a path where the goal of Hasidism is essentially to produce prophets. Not P-R-O-F-I-T, but to produce prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, Nevi'im. He actually argues at length in Mevo HaSharim and elsewhere that Hasidism is the, as a teaching, as a body of teaching, is a discourse which is heir to the teachings and the avoda, the spiritual path of the prophets. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, what he actually articulates what he means. He does not mean that his goal is to produce people who can tell the future, who can issue portents, as they say. He does not mean that. He says, actually, he distinguishes between, you know, what prophets do and who they are. He says it's true that the prophets of old could tell the future. That's true. They could. They were, Nevi'im were sent to Israel to tell them what was going to happen, to push them to do tshuva, to, you know, chastise, to encourage, to inspire. That's all true, and that's what you see in Nevi'im. But he goes on great length in Mevor HaSharim to argue that that's simply what they did. But that's not who they were. In their essence, what it is to be a Navi is to be someone of a particular spiritual level. That's what it means to be a Navi. An expression of that spiritual level is the capacity to, you know, issue portends, etc. But that's not primary to the definition. That's secondary. That's derivative. The primary nature of the prophet is somebody who can, is of a spiritual level. And he says basically that that level is somebody who can see past the division between the physical, the material on the one hand, and the spiritual on the other. Right? Someone who has the capacity to recognize that inhering in the material world itself is divinity. This is not surprising for students of Hasidism, right? Leit atar panui mineh, there's no place without God, right? Malocha la'aretz kibodo. And it, but what he seems to mean by that is not only that, let's say I actually happen to have here like a cup of tea, right? So he says as follows. He says, you know, before the teachings of Kabbalah and the revelation of Kabbalah, you essentially had a firm distinction. You could have argued for a firm distinction between, you know, the holy spheres and the spiritual spheres and the material spheres. And Kabbalah came and said, actually, within like the cup of materialism, within the container of the material world, there's something within there, and that's divinity. Okay. So the metaphor would be like the mug here and the tea. Right? So the mug is a material world, the tea is a spiritual. So within the kelim, as he says, within the kelim, the vessels of materiality, you know, you can find spirituality. But the vessels themselves within that world are still merely vessels. They're still merely, you know, they're not spiritual. They're not God. They're not divine. Comes Hasidism, comes Debesh, the Baal Shem Tov argues to P.S. Eschner, and he reveals a deeper teaching, which is that not only does the cup hold divinity, it is divinity. Materialism itself is divine. God is everything. God is in everything. Right? And if that's the case, then someone who truly recognizes that is a prophet in the sense that they have achieved a consciousness, an insight, a way of seeing Hasidically that they can see past any division between spiritual and spiritual material. Okay. That has many ramifications for spiritual practice, for understandings of reality. But I mentioned that right here already for two reasons. One is I wanted to just clarify what I meant by Hasidic prophets from the get-go. The goal is to create a type of person. He calls him Israeli, a type of Israelite, a type of Jew who has achieved a tremendously sophisticated spiritual level. And the goal is to get them there. That's one reason. But also here when he says, he actually probably means mamash, right? Someone who can actually look outside wherever you are right now, viewers, listeners, and look around the room that you're in and to actually see ro'ebe enav mamash, that God is standing right there, that would be somebody who he's describing here. So he says, and I'll go on for a few more minutes here and then pause. He says that if this person would see Beina Mamash, Echo Mithni Hashem, he wouldn't have any Yetzahara. Right? Rather, Adarabba, just the opposite, on the contrary, his whole nafsho, his whole being would be, you know, enveloped within divinity. The problem is that because we don't have that, right? That is why we actually are forgetful, right? I am in kolach ha'asim margish. Doesn't everyone actually feel, for example, on Yom Kippur, during Kol Nidrei, Ni'ila at least, right? This pure sense, yitul kol tava, nullification of any illicit desires, you know, any parts of themselves which are not good, ratzon lo tov, because his machshava is bara, v'chazaka is b'Hashem. He's clear consciousness at that time. So the question is there any way, and this is part of his point, right? Is there any way to strengthen our consciousness, make it stronger and clearer so that we can have that consciousness, not just lo rak bezmanim elu, not just during those times, and Rosh Hashanah during Shofar, Yom Kippur, rakam tamid, to always have that type of consciousness, that type of clear and strong consciousness, internal life, which is constantly connected with the holy. That's quite the challenge. And that is the goal, I'd say, of his spiritual path, if you're in a nutshell. Now, he articulates going on, I'm going to just summarize, I'll just skip down to here for a moment, two obstacles to this. And this will highlight, you know, if you see the obstacles, you get a sense of what the remedy might be. And then I'll pause for tonight and we'll pick up again next week. Or I'll pause, see if you have any comments, questions, anything like that, and I'll pick it up again next week. He says, I'm over here in Ot Gimel, in the third section here, he says, Shichlul shituach v'chizuk ha-machshava, right, strengthening this consciousness, zehu yisod chevratenu, this is the foundation of our chevra here, the ikar ha-emsei, and the primary means by which the primary means by which we're going to be able to become more tightly connected to avoda, right? Not in the sense of connected to avoda like bechinat bechora shivcha sharacha harichayim, like someone who's sort of like from a distance, right? Sort of imagine like the child of the maidservant he's saying, who behind the mill kind of glimpses the king. He's not talking about that kind of revelation, essentially. Ella keben shemargish et kruvoto.
What are you reading from?
This is from B'nai Machshava Tova.
We're not seeing it.
You don't see that screen? Oh, my screen share is paused.
Yes, it's been pushed for quite a while.
I see it. I don't know. It's showing up on my screen.
I see the manuscript.
Right, it's a manuscript. Right, he's reading from the manuscript.
No, I'm reading from this wiki source page. I'm sorry, I didn't know that you couldn't see it. And I don't know in this moment how to get you back to it. So I'll have to just...
next time.
I will try next time, yes. So what I'll just summarize outside if you're not looking at it inside. What he's saying, he goes on to articulate that part of the problem is that one of the problems is that because we don't have this strong consciousness, even when we do have moments of hitlahavut and spiritual excitement and such, we're unable to hold on to it and to extend it past into, you know, the rest of our time, right? It's sort of happenstance. Inspiration, spiritual enthusiasm, excitement, all of these things happen to us only, like I say, happenstance, only at certain times, which are beyond our control, right? The question is, can we actually extend that to other times as well? Can we choose to become inspired? Can we choose to focus our consciousness to connect to the divine whenever we want to, which is really always, and that's part of his path. What I'm going to do here, actually, is first of all, in the chat, I'm going to just send the URL of that B'nai Machshava Tova so you can see what I was reading from and take a look at it later. Someone asks, if you can see God Mamash and not kilo, I'm not sure what that means. How meaningful is it to treat one well when they're in front of you versus when they're elsewhere with no other date of return? I'm not sure what that means exactly. If Zahav iPad Gold wants to unmute and ask a question, I'm not sure what the question means exactly. I will say that he does articulate the difference. He does talk about the use of imagery and, you know, is it at all appropriate to imagine some sort of iconic, you know, representation of God when trying to do these techniques. But maybe we'll come to that next week. Okay, so what we did tonight, and then I'll pause for a few more minutes if there's any questions and such. I'm not sure what that question meant exactly. I'm sorry, but we introduced you to the context and the biography of the PSS Ner Rebbe, as well as his literary estate and literary legacy. I tried to explain why I think he has achieved such interest and focus these past decades. A little bit about what I think are some of his key innovations, especially on the educational front. But we did the past few minutes, and I'm sorry that you couldn't see the screen, was read parts of his B'nai Machshava Tova, right? That early pamphlet where he lays out, his programmatic essay for spiritual Hasidic development. And the main thing to walk away with from tonight in terms of his teachings is he wants to focus on Machshava Tova, as the book's name implies, right? He thinks that the main problem is forgetfulness, is a lack of not forgetfulness of data, but a lack of consciousness of God, of the divine. And therefore the remedy is to somehow achieve maybe we'd call it mindfulness, I'm not sure that's exactly the right term, but some way of training of the Machshava, and a utilization of the Machshava so that one's internal life is constantly adhering and conscious of the divine, which would entirely change who one is. This ultimately, in the ultimate sense, is the path of the prophets and the goal in his mind of Hasidism. So the goal is to create actually Hasidic prophets, which is no mean task at all. Next week we'll come back and delve more deeply into the texts themselves. Let me pause here. I see a new message. I can stay on a few minutes after 9:30 because I'm not sure what the question is from Zahav iPad Gold. So I'll stay on for a couple minutes and maybe they can just unmute and we can talk. Are there any other thoughts or questions, or Rabbi Kelman, I'm not sure how to proceed here exactly.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Thank you. We can pick up next week. If anybody wants to speak, I'll just invite everybody tomorrow morning. Rabbi Liebtag is starting a new series 3 weeks in a row. Mamad Har Sinai in Parshat Yitro, the first week in Parshat Mishpatim and Beth Hanan. We'll be doing that at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning, live from Israel. And at 8:30, Dr. Mark Shapiro will be continuing his series on the escape of the Mir Yeshiva to Shanghai. And then the rest of the week also, 11 and 8:30, I invite you to check out the schedule, et cetera. So I always like, and if anybody has any questions, we'll thank Rabbi Kelson, and feel free to either to type it in or to speak unmuted. Thank you very much, and live to everybody.
Thanks for tuning in. I'll stay over a couple of minutes.
Usually people don't speak too much. I will tell you my experience is most people are hesitant to talk. I do a lot of talking, they'll chat, and on occasion somebody will speak, but it's usually they prefer to do by chat. So,
no problem.
Okay,
so I'm sitting here for a couple more minutes in case anyone wants to chat, writing or not.
Rabbi Kelson, I have an interesting anecdote that you might find interesting.
Yes,
I was told that the P.S.S. Narev's father, Eli Melech from Grzinsk, is that his name, Eli Melech? So he was an old man when he married Chana Brecha, his wife, the mother of the P.S.S. Narev.
It was his second marriage.
It was his second marriage, but her third marriage. Chana Brecha was married three times, and Eli Melech was her from Grzinsk was her third husband. He had lost two husbands, and her third husband, meaning the father, was an old man. And at the time, he convinced her, he wanted to marry her. And he said, I know I'm much older than you, but I promise you, if we get married, we're going to have very great children. Mm-hmm. And they had two children, obviously the Piasetzner and the brother. And right. he died when he was three, as you mentioned, because he was an old man when they got married.
Yeah. So, thank you. Yeah, that is very interesting. There's a book called...
Just a story. Oh,
thank you, Miriam. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And there's a book called The Rebbe's Daughter, if you're interested, which was it's basically like a fictionalized work by a relative of the Piasetzner. Excuse me. I think a daughter of Rebbe Melech, daughter of Rebbe Chmiel Moshe, excuse me. And Nechemiah Poland translated and annotated that years ago. Mm-hmm. So if you look up, if you order The Rebbe's Daughter, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, lots of interesting anecdotes, and you don't usually have testimony from that perspective.
Well, the reason I know that, I mentioned it to Rabbi Kelman, is that the Piasetzner Rav was my great-grandmother's brother.
Really?
Chana Bracha was married three times, as I mentioned. So her second husband, or her first, I don't know for sure, was Frankel to Omim. Mm. So, and one was Huber Band, another husband, and they gave birth to Shimon Huber Band, one of the members of the Emanuel Ringelblum archive.
Right.
And the one, Frankel to Omim, gave birth to my great-grandmother. And then, the third husband was Elimelech from Grzinsk, was the third husband. So my great-grandmother and the Piasetzner Rav were half-brothers and sisters.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. So that's how I know these.
It's really a privilege and really cool to have you hear that.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Laila Tov, everybody, I think. And thank you very much. And please, God, we'll see you next week and beforehand, too, during the course of the week.
Okay, thank you.
Be well, everybody.
Yeah, bye-bye.